continuing with J.G. Davies on 11 August 78. Yeah, this 12th. Question of
12th, yes.
This question of the origin of the meteors. Could you go into that?
Yes.
How did that problem come up then?
Well, it came from the optical observers. There were two sets of optical observers who had made measurements of the velocity of meteors by various techniques for estimating the speed across the sky and the distances. One of these was Erpik, who first in Lithuania and then in Northern Ireland had a technique which indicated that many meteors were moving much too fast to be moving in the solar system on hyperbolic orbits. And then there was Hofmeister in Sonneberg, and it's now Eastern Germany, who had the opposite view.
And were they using different techniques?
They were differing techniques. They both sounded good, but one had a rocking mirror, and you saw the meteor path doing this sort of thing as you looked down in the mirror, and optical effects, physiological effects, I suspect. There were no photography. Direct photography wasn't possible,
right.
Made the suspect in the mirror. Now, we therefore set out to measure the velocities, and if you get the directions as well, then this was even better, but initially only velocities with some direction. Since you had a narrow beam, the meteor had to be in perpendicular to that beam,
right.
One but not two dimensions, coordinates for its direction. And we could not, using that technique, we could find no evidence for more than experimental observational errors over the limiting the parabolic velocity.
Right, which is what, 45?
42 relative to the sun, but then the Earth has a velocity of 30,
right, so
if they're moving in opposite directions, it could be up to 72 kilometers a second. But you knew the direction of the Earth's motion, and if you knew the direction which you were looking, you could do some geometry on it, of course.
Right.
But when we had the three-station system measuring actual directions as well as velocities, then of course we could measure the orbits of individual meteors, and still, this is what thesis from back.
Well, I see you did a thesis at Jodl.
My thesis was at Jodl on meteors.
And when did that finally, when was that awarded?
51, 52, something like that. But the conclusion certainly was that there was no evidence for a significant proportion of hyperbolic, if you measured 1,000 or something like this, and none of those were any marginally beyond experimental errors.
Now, were you in contact with Erpik and Hofmeister?
Yes, both of them, as far as one could communicate with Eastern Germany, of course. Erpik was a difficult character in some ways. Hofmeister's a nice chap. I did go over. I have seen him, met him there. He's dead now.
Uh-huh.
I had met him over there. And we got on. We had communication with both of these. We also had active communication with an amateur group in England, led particularly by Prentice, who were making optical observations, and indeed they would often come to Jodrell and make simultaneous observations.
Right.
So we could relate the meteor echo with a meteor of particular visual characteristic, and this was very important.
Now what did Erpik and Hofmeister think? Did they visit Jodrell themselves, actually, in these early years?
Erpik certainly did. Hofmeister, no.
I see. Yeah. But, I mean, did he sort of look around and harumph and say, well, this is not astronomy, or was he seriously trying to figure out exactly what you were measuring? And
I think that Erpik was quite an old man by then, and he'd had a very hard life. He'd lost all his records in getting out of the East, and he never really accepted that our measurements could be good. We must have been missing it for one, and he searched for methods of saying why we were not seeing the many hyperbolic meteors which had to be.
Oh, I see. His theory. You were missing them.
We were missing them somehow. He didn't say we weren't making good observations.
I see. And did he publish this sort of argument also?
I think yes, he must have done it. I couldn't cite it though.
What about other optical astronomers, or I guess since you were just in the media radar.
There was a conference in, must have been in 49, in Manchester. I guess it's published in, Reports in Progress of Physics, something like this, I think, about that date.
I see, on media.
Which Erpik attended, I remember this.
I see.
And, on, yes, on meteors.
Mm-hmm.
So and I think you'll find something there.
Okay, I'll check that. Now, of course, you must have been educating yourself all this time in astronomy.
Oh, yes.
And how did you do that? Just reading the journals, or?
I suppose partly. We are, of course, part of the physics department in Manchester, and in those days under Blackett's direction. And he supported us very greatly. Of course, the department was expanding rapidly after the war, which gave great opportunities. And it was not long after that, I'm not sure yet exactly when the chair of astronomy was established there, largely with the idea that it would support the work going on. And so we had, and in the early days, we had many lectures from of course, Kopal.
Took out the chair. Was he in the physics department actually?
He was an astronomer. Oh yes. First originating from Czechoslovakia, and he had been in the States for some time. And he was the first occupant of that chair, and still is in that. And he taught us basic astronomy.
Right.
Very well too.
Now, as you look back in the late 40s, when there was a group, I guess, of a staff of 10 or something like that?
I suppose so,
be accurate. And then, of course, in the early 50s, Hanbury Brown came and others, began to be more students. Did the nature of the place change, would you say?
It must have. Obviously, as it grew and grew more permanent, it changed somewhat, but...
How would you characterize those? The important changes?
Well, in the early days, if you wanted to do an experiment, or a student was going to write his thesis on a particular thing, he would spend the first year building the equipment, and then he'd do the experiment and write it out. As time goes on, of course, you get more and more of the equipment given to you, which has some advantages and some disadvantages as well, and some students never understand what the equipment does. But that's an inevitable feature.
Was this process already beginning in the early 50s, so you're saying, or was that somewhat later?
Yes, it was, because even any meteor radar, of course, a fairly complex thing, and parts of that were given, but, for example, the precise recording technique required for producing the diffraction pattern that I was interested in was developed, and so on.
A question which we haven't touched on is the origin of the equipment that you did have in the late 40s. Was it all military surplus?
Yes, military surplus, so you could go out and buy a 100 kilowatt transmitter for £10. Listen, provided you towed it back yourself. And the receiver which went with it, which was again 3 racks of equipment, was £5. I remember those figures quite clearly.
and
it stopped them being tipped down an old mine shaft.
And how long did this sort of a situation continue before you finally had to adapt?
A few years, 3 or 4 years, I suppose. And you could go on buying surplus equipment from stores for some time after that at a very cheap rate. And a great deal of our early equipment was built on that sort of basis.
But there must have been quite a bit of modification that you had to do for your special purposes, or is that not true to this equipment?
Only in the recording. In the control, yes, we made crystal control pulse generators, for example, because pulse repetition rate was important to us. And in the recording devices were special, but the basic equipment,
and
the telescope, the area system we used was special too. We built a 210-foot parabolic telescope in 1950 with our own hands.
Right. Well, but before we get to that stage, I mean, the earlier meteor radars, were they just once again just adopted for military service?
Oh, yes.
What exactly were they? Just the Yagi arrays?
Yes, Yagi arrays.
Now, okay, so what was it that made the group decide, apparently, that more needed to be done than just meteor radar astronomy? What would you say was the thrust? Were you thinking that, well, it was getting, like, we solved the problems, or...
Meteors really dropped out because it became less and less compatible to try to do active and passive work on the same site. For a long time, the meteor systems, we had several radars going simultaneously. They all transmitted simultaneously. They were all coherent, of course, so they interfere with each other. They also produce suppression pulses, which suppress the radio astronomy receivers. And of course, as soon as one started thinking about the sensitivity of this process. It obviously wasn't a very sensible thing to do.
And time-sharing didn't...
Time-sharing didn't got less and less useful, and so we gave that up. But even after that, I went on and did some work. My later papers were purely sort of theoretical calculations on perturbations of meteor orbits and the generation of some rather extraordinary meteor showers.
I see. You mean
in fact, the Jacobinid meteor shower, which produced an enormous number of meteors for about 10 minutes in several years, the latest one being 1946, we were able to show must have actually come out of the parent comet within about 3 or 4 months, and I think 1892.
I see.
Trace it back to an event. It must have happened.
But this was an analysis you did in the late 50s?
Yes, with a Pole called Tursky.
But no, you're implying that they more or less made you turn your transmitters off, and so you had to turn to theory at a certain stage, or interpretation?
Well, by that time we were mainly on radio astronomy, and it was sort of a lingering interest in meteors, which kept that particular...
What is this, the late 50s that we're talking about now?
When you did this? Guess so, yes, it's late.
In fact, I just talked to John Evans up at Helsinki, and he told me about this conflict between the active and the passive people.
It went on with the lunar and planetary radar later than the meteor.
A bit longer, yes. So it was a matter, really, then you were transmitting pretty much every day, I guess.
Oh, those were survey equipments, yes, without going continuously.
It wasn't a matter that there was just a few meteor showers during the year, and you were...
Well, there were meteor showers when we did concentrated observations, but much of the observations were surveyed.
And of course, you discovered many new ones this way in daytime.
Yes.
I don't really know this much about the field. I think it's one of the most interesting aspects of the whole radar medium field is its ability to see the other half of the sky.
Yes, I think that is a good half of the story.
Well, maybe I should ask you that, and of course the business about the solar system origin of the meteors, which...
That was probably the most important thing. I mean, the fact that there were meteors in the other half is reasonably predictable. It was nice to know, yes.
Right. What kind
and they were somewhat different in character from the nighttime.
I see. How's that?
The nighttime streams were mainly fairly good and concentrated things. You got a few days regularly.
Yeah.
Now, the summer daytime streams, as we call them, was a continuous procession. It lasted May, June, and July, 3 months, and one radiant came and another one went. It sort of moved across the sky with the sun.
Mm-hmm.
An enormous area of activity, which was more diffuse than the nighttime showers, and much more long lasting.
And concentrated in these 3 months?
Concentrated in those 3 months. It had peaks in it.
But why is that? Why is this annual effect?
Well, all meteor showers are annual in that the Earth's orbit has to intersect the meteor.
No, but I mean...
Why in the summer?
Why in those 3 months?
I don't think there is a good reason for it. I mean, there's no such thing as... No similar thing in the southern hemisphere. In the southern hemispheres...
I see.
Summer.
Or in the southern hemisphere... You mean in their daytime showers, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, they have some daytime showers, but they don't have an enormous concentration as we did in their summer months when, I mean, there is an annual effect to be expected as the ecliptic rising sets in the sky. That was a particular concern with.
But what other important results would you think that we came out of this meteor radar work, either in astronomy or ionospheric physics?
Well, I think the physics of the formation of the meteor trail and its recombination was quite important. And Kaiser, was the chief worker in that field, had to study it.
And is it a fair statement to say that these main two astronomical results, once they were established, the field sort of died out because it wasn't clear what further direction to go? This is the late 50s now I'm talking about?
The field did go on, not with us. Whipple in particular continued both radar and photographic work. Satellite program used in this for cameras became making good photographic observations. And that led to further information about the actual meteor was, the sort of particles and materials it's made of, which rather little information came from the radio, more from the optical side.
Right. But do you agree that the field sort of peaked in the mid 50s or
I think so, yes. I mean, it may be partly a personal view, right. But I think that probably is less important now. They had a good time over there.
Okay, well, let's go back to the development of Jodrell Bank. The decision to build something like, for instance, the 218, was it? Non-movable dish. Was a decision like this arrived about from a consensus of the group, or was it sort of one of the subgroup leaders decided he wanted it and then would go to Lovell and make his arguments? Or
it was a small group in those days. I mean, it wasn't, not all the students would be involved in that. So Lovell and Henry, I think, basically.
And what was the why was there a need felt to do other than meteor radar work, which was pretty exclusively what was done in the late 40s?
I think it's a general interest in expanding into astronomy. The use of radio techniques in astronomy was always there. We started in the meteors, certainly, but very rapidly moving over into other fields.
You mean simply that you saw that this was going on and interesting results were coming out?
Yes.
To get into it?
Yes.
Do you have any thoughts on why the Jodrell Bank approach tended to be more one of the big dish, not exclusively, but more so than the Cambridge approach where interferometry played more of a role?
Well, I guess that the partly personality matter, but also, of course, nationally, you couldn't support two groups doing the same thing. And by choosing different techniques, we became complementary groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, Professor Lovell made this remark to me that it would be silly, to say the least, for him and Ryle to argue in these national
committees. Yes, well, that was always true. I mean, they came to external agreements about what they were going to do before they went to the committee.
And supporting each other for this year. You scratch my back and I'll scratch yours, essentially.
Yes.
You were never involved in the lunar radar work, is that correct?
No.
Always in the meteor. So,
yes.
Let's see. What, as you look back on the 40s to 50s era, what is it that made the radar work? Well, you made one point. Was it the conflict with the passive people? Was that really what made it fade out at Jodrell? The primary reason? What other reasons might there be?
I think that was the primary reason. It may have also been part of the chance that those principally concerned either had left, or in my case, my interest started to swing over to the other side. I wanted to.
You mean John Evans leaving and the lunar radar?
Yes, and Greenhow and Kaiser and so on. They all moved on.
And what did your interest switch to, and when did that happen?
Well, I've always had a sort of technical interest as well as an astronomical one, and I'm not too sure. And then, I was always concerned with the construction of our large telescopes. I was responsible for the control system of the Mark I, and I'd say it was an analog computer, which I designed, and then with the digital control of the Mark II, which I think the first large instrument to have an online computer attached to it.
Now, when was that?
The Mark I was complete in 57, the Mark II in 63. Some 4 or 5 years earlier in each case, when his interest started.
But the difference in time was in a matter that many computers have become available on the market so that one could
we see the analog computer was entirely valves. It went transistors when we thought about that, and you couldn't envisage using a valve digital computer from the reliability point of view. That's what wouldn't have been on.
I see.
So the analog system was used many fewer valves, and therefore was adequately accurate.
You mean the one they used to control the Mark I, for example?
Yes.
Right. Now, of course, Professor Lovell's written a book about the whole building of the big dish, and we don't need to go into most of the dates and all of it. I would be interested in your comments on what were the unique aspects of this design, and what were the basic problems that had to be solved as the design and the construction went along.
Well, of course, it was the first structure like that which was made sort of completely tenable. The engineers regarded it as sort of a bridge problem with an extra dimension of motion added to it.
Well, in fact, Husband. Were a bridge building.
Yes.
And but they felt that it was quite doable. I mean, something that hadn't been done before.
After all, the specification was to work at a wavelength of 1 meter. In fact, we now use it to up to 6 centimeters.
Meaning that you had quite a bit of tolerance.
We had a lot of tolerance. Yes. In fact, it would not work mechanically if you made it as sloppy as the astronomical tolerance allowed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a better instrument than that.
What were the other considerations that had to go into the design, as far as compromises and so forth? For instance, the feed, the situation where you had to put your life on the limb a little bit to get up there.
Yes.
It seems to me a little bit strange. Yeah.
Yes, well, we hadn't sort of visualized the problem too much in the earlier stages. There were various schemes involved, and they've changed, of course. That has changed quite a lot, of course.
Well, in the present version of the telescope.
But initially, of course, the long wavelength was only going to be an open dipole there anyhow, which required very little attention once you had some means of getting it there. And now where you have very much amplifiers and cooling systems and so on,
the
situation is very different.
That's true. Once you're thinking you're just taking the signal down.
Right, by cable, at least to the base, to the center, right. To the apex of the dish.
As had been done with the 218.
Right, the same idea.
Right. What about in the pointing control? Was there any particular problems?
No, I don't think so. It was done, as I say, with an analog device, but using maxlet resolvers to produce sine and cosine voltages, which were then multiplied and added and so on to solve the appropriate equations. There are problems. We don't think to go along in the zenith and so on, this sort of thing.
But yeah.
They're less difficult to solve that way, I think, than in a mechanical analog, which can actually jam up.
Which, for instance, like the NRL, the 50-foot dish head, is that
what? Yes, that's that sort of thing.
Right. Now, that brings up another point about the azimuth altitude mounting.
Yes.
Were you at all bothered by this, seeing as, I guess, except for the NRL dish, all previous dishes of any size have been equatorially mounted. Well, of course, they weren't of any size.
That's right. You
see. That's right. Drinkalo hadn't even come along.
Yes. No, when you get to, I think that an equatorial mount of that size been, and still is quite impossible.
Yes, right. But did this not bother you at all in terms of course, the disadvantages of polarization characteristics and possible tracking difficulties? Did it seem like?
No. Polarization was a secondary issue probably in those days, and tracking did not seem to be a problem there. Right
from the very beginning. Why was it then, I still have difficulty understanding why, for instance, the 140-foot people, which came along many years after your experience, really thought they had to have an equatorial mount,
I don't know. Just ask them.
Well, I haven't got really good answers.
So, I mean, they had more engineering difficulties with that, of course, than we did.
Right.
Because of its equatorial nature.
You think that was a basic problem?
No, I think so. I mean, I think that to all the whole bearing problems they had would not have occurred in that.
Yeah. Okay, well, are there any other aspects of in particular, your astronomical career prior to 1960 or so that I've missed? As I say, unfortunately, I don't have a bibliography. Important points about the development of radio astronomy in Great Britain that...
I don't think there was anything else. Nothing startling occurs to mind.
One final question. Let's start in the early 50s and then say later on in the 50s, what would you have called yourself if your neighbor asked you what
astronomer.
You do? An astronomer.
Yes, astronomer first.
Even in the early 50s?
Yeah, in the early 50s, yes.
Now that's interesting because most radio astronomers, as we now call them, wouldn't have answered that at that time. Was this because you were working so much in a field related to optical astronomy, perhaps? Or?
I don't think so, no. I'm surprised at your comment, actually. Maybe it was, I don't think it was true in England, let's put it that way.
mean, the optical astronomers had accepted us and did right from the beginning, you know, which was a little remarkable, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And,
accepted you in which sense?
Well, in
listened
the,
to you at RAS meetings?
That's right, as members of the RAS, and you know, we got very full. Any paper we submitted, we were asked to read as well in mm-hmm. the meetings.
Which were the key people, would you say, in the optical astronomy side in Great Britain who welcomed in this new field? Because in other countries, there was not always this close cooperation.
Well, I wouldn't want to mention names, but because I think all of them.
I see.
I don't recall any...
You don't remember anyone particularly who was...
Anybody being against it, but against the astronomical literature.
I see. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Not at all.
That ends the interview with J.G. Davies on 12 August 78.